Awesome. All right. Well, I may have a hard time living up to everything that Kelly's taught you so far, but I'm really excited to be here. I always really enjoy talking to the, well, I've enjoyed talking to the previous ISSYP classes. I'm sure I'll enjoy talking to you guys too. So I'm actually, after I wrote my title, I wrote my talk. And so the title was mostly about experiments, but I'm going to be talking really sort of 50-50 about theory and experiment and how they fit together. But the starting point for where I'd like to talk about this is goes back about 3 years ago. Yeah, 3 years and 2 weeks, to the discovery of the Higgs particle at the LHC. So how many of you guys remember this? Yeah? All right. Pretty much everyone. Awesome. So this was a really big deal, certainly for everybody in the field of particle physics. But I always thought, wow, you know, if I wasn't a particle physicist, I'd have a really hard time understanding what the big deal was about this discovery. Because honestly, it's like, oh, we found this particle. And wait, but can you give me some of them? No. you know, can I see them? No. Where are they? Nowhere. So given that, and that they're like, woohoo, this is what a Higgs looks like, but we're not actually sure if that's a Higgs or not. And all this stuff, I felt like this is a good starting point for going back to, you know, what is this particle business? Why are we so obsessed with it? Why is it such a big deal? What are we learning from studying these particles? Why is it important? And then how do we learn about them? How do we actually, because fundamentally, all of these particles, whether they decay in femtoseconds or are actually stable and form part of, you know, of this, of your tables and your pens and paper, all of them are really part of the building blocks part for the structure we use to understand nature. And that's ultimately why they're important to understand. But to get to that, I need to back up a little bit. And so the sort of remarkable thing that we've learned, really, I'd say mostly over the last century, is that, but it's, and the fact that this has continued to be true for a century is kind of amazing, that all the phenomena we've seen in nature can be accommodated by a quantum theory of interacting particles. Now, I could say explained instead of accommodated, but I think that would certainly sound better. But I think it would be a bit of a cheat. The reason I say accommodated is that there's still many big things about this theory we don't understand. Why those particular particles instead of other ones? Why, you know, what struck, what, there's a lot of structure in this theory. Where does it come from? And we don't know why. In some cases, we have phenomena that we know we can explain with particles, but we don't even know what kinds of particles we're talking about. That was the situation with the Higgs 3.5 years ago, by the way. We knew that that was a phenomenon to do with particles, but we didn't know what kinds of particles we were actually going to find. We still don't know. There might be more particles to do with the physics of the Higgs that we just haven't found yet. So those are big questions that keep me from using a really confident word like explains in this sentence. But it's still a pretty powerful sentence that basically everything we've seen in nature can be fit within the framework of a quantum theory of interacting particles. And you know, I said this traces back a century, and you know, I put down 1932 here. Of course, before that, we were also working with atoms that were kind of like particles, right? Periodic table. And then realized that actually they had smaller building blocks, electron, protons, and neutrons, made up atoms. And our understanding since then, oh, my pointer doesn't work. Okay, that's fine. I'll just stop using it then. it's not a big deal. I don't really need it. Hockey stick? Yeah. When I have something to point to, I'll pull out the hockey stick. I know where to find it. All right. And so these are the particles that we really learn about in, you know, in our high school classes. But we've since gone beyond to an even bigger synthesis and even more fundamental description of how nature works, which goes by this awful name of the standard model. So I want to back up and explain why the standard model, which has a very uncool name, is actually cool. And to do that, I should back up a little bit from all these particles I've been talking about. Because, if you think about the world as like a play, the particles are all the actors that are running around. But there's really three principles that set the stage, that lay the groundwork for this theory, and that make it kind of inevitable, actually, that the world should be described by a theory of particles. And I guess two of these, quantum mechanics and relativity, are what you've been talking a lot about over the last week, Kelly. So I'll present maybe a slightly different angle on them, but hopefully it connects in some ways. And then the third one, I really think of at a very pragmatic level as the fact that you can do ex that science works, that experiments can be reproduced. And I'll explain why that's important. So quantum mechanics, one of the biggest things that quantum mechanics did is it totally changed what we think the right questions to ask in science are. It used to be before quantum mechanics that the questions you tried to ask were if you start from, start a ball from position A, what happens? Where does it go? Right? And we can still ask that question a lot of the time, but in quantum mechanics, you don't actually know. It may not always go to the same place. Right? And so the questions you have to ask are instead, what's the probability for state A to go to state B or to state C? What are sort of all the different probabilities for what your starting state can do? And actually, the thing you build those probabilities out of is what's called an amplitude, which is just basically the square root of the probability. So this kind of this amplitude thing should be the goal of any theory, is to figure out what are the states and what are the amplitudes connecting them. And what's important is that because the amplitude squared is a probability, and the probability that something happens is always one, like the sum of probabilities has to add up to one, that gives you rules that relate complicated amplitudes to simple amplitudes. Because you can say, well, I mean, let me just talk about this in the language of probabilities. Rather than amplitudes, because it's a little more intuitive that way. But if you think about, well, the probability of A going to B is the probability of A going to anything times the probability of that thing going to B, right? And then actually, because you're not doing a measurement in between, in quantum mechanics, that rule is followed by the amplitudes rather than the probabilities, but it's pretty much the same idea. So that tells you that if I had an amplitude that had some complicated states at the beginning and end, simple state in the middle, or sorry, complicated states beginning and the end, that is related to a sum that includes simple states in the middle and even more complicated states in the middle. And so there's all these relations between different amplitudes. Okay, that's not the only relation we have between different amplitudes. In fact, as I come back to those other two principles, we'll see more and more relations. The other really important rule is special relativity. Okay, and special relativity, as you've learned, is basically it's what we call an example of what we call a symmetry, where if you look at the same process in a different reference frame, you'll get the same answer. So that's true when you combine it with quantum mechanics, that's still true. Now the questions you have to ask are questions about amplitudes. So if I have one amplitude and I look at a related amplitude, well, actually, let me back up. Before I take two amplitudes, I'll just start from the states because amplitudes have to do with going from one state to another. So whenever you have a symmetry, you know that the right way to think about, to organize your thinking about the theory is to describe states in a way that they transform nicely under that symmetry. So either they're invariant or they like, when you rotate around a circle, they come back to themselves plus one or something like that. Some nice, simple behavior under a symmetry. So, with the symmetry of relativity, that's a symmetry that, hey, an experiment I do here, sorry, without dropping my hockey stick, an experiment I do here, an experiment I do here should look the same. Or an experiment I do now, an experiment I do tomorrow, I should get the same answer. Or an experiment that I do on a moving train, an experiment I do here standing still, should look the same. That tells us how to organize states. That I should think of states as being built out of things that transform really simply under all those different manipulations, speeding something up, moving it over, things like that. And what that works out to is that the things that transform simply under that symmetry, you can think of them as having the properties of a particle. Okay, whether they're really like balls of material or not, who knows, right? That's sort of, but at a mathematical level, they behave like a thing with a momentum and some kind of quantum mechanical spin. Okay, so we call those particles, and that is really what we mean by particles. Not necessarily a ball of stuff, but just something that behaves under the symmetries of relativity the way a particle would. And what that means is that when we talk about states built out of those, so changing, putting a particle on a train changes its momentum. Then if you do that change of reference frame that takes states A and B to some other states, A prime and B prime, the amplitudes had better be related in a predictable way. So again, we have more relationships between the different amplitudes. And then the last piece I mentioned was what I called reproducibility of experiments. This is basically that if I have some self-contained system that I'm doing experiments on here in Waterloo, I don't need to know everything that's going on elsewhere in the universe in order to predict what I'm going to get. Right? I don't need to know what the weather's like on Mars. I don't need to know, whether there's a storm on Jupiter. I don't need to know whether there's some alien on another star doing an experiment over there. That's basically telling you that if I have a state that's split into two pieces that are far away from each other, then its probabilities for how it evolves or its amplitudes should be a product of amplitudes for the two sort of subpieces of the state, right? So those three rules, they sound really abstract, okay? I know they are really abstract, but believe it or not, if you build those three rules together, what you find is that there's sort of a unique possibility that we're talking about a theory of particles, or equivalently to particles. I'll come back to this in a minute. We can think about it as a theory of fields. But so fields that cover all of space, just like when you talk about a gravitational field or an electric field, but that interact with one another at points. And these two sound like really different descriptions, but in a quantum mechanical theory, they're actually equivalent to one another. So if I want to build a theory that follows these rules, I need to figure out what are the particles in my theory and how do they interact with one another. And so that's why we really care about finding each and every one of these particles and learning about their properties. Is that's the handle on what is the structure of the laws of nature. So let me give you just one example of both how particles are connected to laws of nature and how particles are connected to fields. Because when I think about laws of nature, I don't think about, the periodic table. I think about like electromagnetism, Coulomb's law. Right? And Coulomb's law, yeah, maybe you've got some particles, but basically the deal is that if I have some charged thing, some other charged thing, it's going to feel a force and the force is going to deflect it. Right? And I can think of that force in terms of an electric field that's just filling the space around every charged particle. And so in this example, I've used a proton and electron as the two particles that I'm thinking about in the electric field. But the thing that I'd really associate with the laws of nature here isn't the proton and the electron necessarily, it's the field. Okay? But now I want to show you how you can recast that field in terms of and relate that to another particle. So we need another ingredient from quantum mechanics to do this, which is the uncertainty principle. So the uncertainty principle tells you that you can't know exactly where a particle is. This is not going to connect until 2 or 3 slides from now to Maxwell's equations or Coulomb's law. You can't know exactly where a particle is and how fast it's going at the same time. And you can't know exactly, and there's a similar relationship between time and energy. That if you measure something at a particular time, you don't know exactly how much energy it has. I like to think of this energy and time uncertainty relationship as being a little bit like borrowing from a bank. So, well, okay. I was thinking about that analogy last night, and I'm like, you know, when I was in high school, I didn't borrow from a bank. That's like one of the most boring things about being an adult, is borrowing from banks. You know, but sometimes you borrow from your parents. And then I'm like, actually, this is a lot more like borrowing from your parents than borrowing from a bank. So if you ask your parents for, at least my parents, if you ask them to lend me, if I ask them to lend me, you know, $2 for something, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll pay you back later. Okay, that's fine. If I ask them to lend me $100, they're like, what do you want $100 for? You better give that money right back to me. Right? So the more you ask for, the faster they want it back. And this quantum mechanics bank is kind of similar, that basically, the shorter a time you're borrowing from it, the more energy you can borrow. Okay, and when we think about different particles interacting and getting phenomena from different particles interacting, you've got to keep that in mind, that you can actually be affected by particles that you don't have enough energy to produce normally. But you can borrow that energy from the quantum bank. But you have to borrow it for a very short amount of time. And the more energy you need, the shorter the time you need it for. And that will be important in the examples that we see. So, what does this uncertainty principle really mean if we're talking about an electron moving along? One thing it means is that we can never really be sure whether it's just an electron or whether there's an electron and a photon sort of hanging out together. If you measure it, say by, you know, by shooting some other thing at it, sometimes you'll see an electron coming out. Sometimes you'll see that part of that energy was actually carried by a photon. Now, this quantum bank, like once you measure something, you always get back the same energy. Energy is conserved. But it's useful to think about things as going through intermediate states where you might add more energy. So now we've got electrons sort of shooting off their photons and then reabsorbing them. And the higher the energy of that photon, the shorter the time it better be doing it in. But what happens now when I have two particles, say an electron and a proton, both shooting off these photons? Well, now what can happen is every now and then, instead of the electron absorbing its own photon, the photon's just going to get absorbed by the proton. There's nothing stopping it. If that's an allowed interaction, and that's an allowed interaction, then this should be too. And so it'll get reabsorbed by the other particle. And that, Feynman was the one that figured this out, that is another way of understanding electric and magnetic forces. As just charged particles are absorbing and emitting these photons all the time. These are particles of light, but they are also, when you're exchanging them between one particle and another, they're really giving rise to the same forces that we thought about earlier as coming from the electromagnetic fields. So there's a connection between these two ways of thinking about the physics. Either particles are doing it all or fields are doing it all. They're really and truly equivalent. Sometimes it's more useful to think about it one way to do some calculations, and sometimes the other way. But they're really encoding the same thing. Once you figure out how to do the same calculation in the two different ways, you always get the same answer, whether you think about it as a particle or as a field as long as you do the quantum mechanics consistently both ways. Okay, so that's just electrons, protons, and photons. That's a small number of particles. When we talk about the standard model, we have a whole zoo of particles. So besides the electron and the photon, we've got neutrinos, up and down quarks, charm and strange quarks, top and bottom quarks, muons, taus, and these other kinds of force particles that none of these quarks or neutrinos or the force particles are really visible in everyday life. Gravity we can see as a force, but we've never really seen the particles. We've never even seen gravitational waves. I'm not sure if that's part of what Latham will be talking about later today or not. But gravity waves are pretty cool. Except that they haven't been seen yet. They will be cool when they're seen. There's the Higgs. And then there's other things that we know are out there, and I'll talk a little bit about this at the end, like dark matter. We don't know what they are. That's why it's got this really like confused looking particle symbol on here. So, a couple things about this diagram. Most of the stuff on here is totally unfamiliar and invisible in everyday life. And that's for a couple of different reasons that I'll explain to you in a minute. There's really sort of two pieces to it, three pieces to it, actually. And there's also all these mirror particles, antimatter, which is not something that we saw in the previous versions of the periodic table, but it's really a sort of essential fact about any theory with the symmetries of special relativity that once you have any theory with electrons in it that can so just like I talked about photons being emitted and absorbed by different particles, you could also have situations where an electron's emitted and absorbed. And in order to make sense of those theories consistently and have them be consistent with relativity, you just have to have an antiparticle associated with it. So Dirac predicted what was eventually called a positron based on that. Actually, originally, he was like, oh no, what's wrong with this theory? It's beautiful in every way, except that it has this new particle in it that we don't know about. And then he thought, oh, maybe that could be the proton. And there's this whole saga of confusion about whether there really was a new particle there or not, which was actually resolved pretty quickly because Anderson found a particle in his experiment that looked just like an electron. It bent the same way under magnetic fields, except in the opposite direction. And one way to understand why antiparticles are really important is that they mean that charge is conserved, right? So if you only had electrons, then you can never produce more electrons without violating that charge conservation. But once you have a negative and a positive charge, you can go either way. You can go from lots of energy to producing an electron and a positron, or you can take an electron and positron, annihilate them together, and just get out a burst of energetic light, gamma rays. And so one way to think about this is just that, when you have two charged particles interacting with one another, you know that there's a potential energy depending that increases the closer they get. So at some point, that potential energy gets bigger than mc squared for an electron and a positron. And it's at that point that you expect some of the time you will produce an electron and a positron. And in fact, you can apply the same idea to basically all the particles in the standard model. That's how we've gone around looking for them. That as long as you conserve any interaction that conserves energy, momentum, and charge, and a couple of other symmetries that we've learned about, will happen some fraction of the time. Okay, so if I take an electron and a proton, and I got them close enough together, I would eventually produce some fraction of the time all the really rare weird particles of the Standard Model. And you just have to look for them. Okay, so given that all these things are out there, that I've told you that in some sort of basic fundamental sense they are building blocks of nature, why don't we see any of these crazy other particles? Well, like I said, there's a couple of different reasons depending on which particle you ask about. So I'll start with these weak interaction particles, why we don't see them, their effects, why we don't see this force, and why we don't see the neutrinos, which are unique among all these particles as the only ones that only interact through the weak force. And you might ask, how weak are the weak interactions? Well, one answer is that they're weak enough that even though you have, I guess this is a trillion, yeah, a trillion neutrinos a second passing through your brain, you don't notice them every second. Okay? Trillions of neutrinos, they don't bother you. In fact, in order to see neutrinos at all, even with a very low efficiency, physicists build these gigantic detectors. So this one is, I think, the biggest still to date, Super Kamiokande. That's a boat with two people in it. Okay, and that's like a third of the detector. really huge. And still, most of the neutrinos that go through this, they go right through it, don't leave any signal. This is just seeing a small fraction of the neutrinos. On the other hand, I could also say, oh, if I did high energy experiments, LHC, I'd say, well, they're not that weak. Because actually, you see the, once you get into sort of high energy collisions, you see the particles responsible for the weak interactions, the W and the Z, pretty often. So which one's right? Are they really weak or are they pretty strong? Well, it's a bit of both. And so I want to go back to this quantum bank idea and to the key difference between the weak force and electromagnetic forces. So electromagnetic forces are associated with, you can think about them as electrons and protons trading photons. And photons have no mass, right? Light is massless. That means it travels at the speed of light. Okay, that's kind of tautological. But the weak force is the exchange of these particles called the W and the Z, and they're heavy, about 100 times the mass of the proton. So that mass translates into a minimum energy, which by this uncertainty principle translates to a maximum time that you can borrow energy to produce them. And that means they don't travel very far. So if I have, let's say, a proton wandering around, every now and then, I can't tell whether it's really a proton or a proton and a photon, or a proton and a Z, because the proton also couples to the Z. So some of the time, it's not going to be just trading off a photon, emitting and absorbing a photon. It's going to be emitting and absorbing a Z. But these Zs can't travel very far because they're too heavy. They don't live long enough by the uncertainty principle. A neutrino can also be emitting and absorbing Zs, but if they're far enough away, there's no way that a Z from over here can get to over here, right? That would just require too much time for the amount of energy that it takes to get a Z out. And so that means that's why the neutrinos sail right past stuff. It's only when they get really, really close to one another that you could get these Z interactions. So if I talk about a neutrino from the sun, and these neutrinos, just to give you a sort of very rough order of magnitude, their energy is about the mass equivalent to the mass energy of an electron, even though that's not actually where their energy comes from, but it's about the same scale. About 1,000th the total energy of the proton, which means that they have this big wave function that's basically always spread out over a much larger space than this distance that the Zs can travel. So most of the time, they're going to breeze right past an atom in the water without the neutrino ever getting close enough to the protons or the electrons in that atom to exchange Z. If you went to really high energies, or to really short, then you could start probing really short distance physics, and you'd see that at really short distances, the neutrino, this Z, actually has a mediates a force that basically has the same 1 over r structure as, or 1 over r squared structure as an electric force. In fact, you'd see that not only does the force have the same structure as electromagnetism, it's actually about 5 times stronger. So they're weak at long distances, but actually kind of strong at short distances. And it all has to do with the fact that the particle responsible for that, or related to that force, is really heavy. Okay, so this also gives you an idea of why, if you want to study these weak forces more precisely, you need accelerators. So first of all, you need high energies in order to actually probe small distances reliably. And if you wanted to actually produce, not just borrow a Z from the quantum bank, then you can't really do anything with it. You want to really produce Zs that you can see what they do. And to do that, you also need a lot of energy. So either to look at short distances, or just to produce, have enough energy to produce these massive particles with equals mc squared, you would need large distances. Now, that only explains why you can't see 3 out of the 12 particles types of matter on that chart that I showed. But the weak forces have one more trick up their sleeves, which is that besides the Z, there's another particle called the W. The W is actually electrically charged, and it also mediates a force, but it's a force that, since the W is charged, changes one type of particle into another. So for example, it changes a neutron into a proton, a neutrino into an electron. And there's other examples too. Now, this, by the way, is actually the first bit of the weak interaction. Well, the first bit of the weak interactions that was discovered was really this one on the next slide. Radioactive decays. So I can just take that diagram and sort of swivel it around, and I get this kind of diagram. So a neutron can turn into a proton and a W. Now you're like, wait, the W is 100 times more massive than the neutron. That's okay, because I'm just borrowing energy from the bank to produce it. That's not a real W that I can keep at the end of the day. And then the W can, through that W, I can produce an electron, and the antiparticle of a neutrino, which is the antineutrino. And now that I'm done trading in that W at the quantum bank for the electron and antineutrino, you see that this final state actually has less mass than the total mass than the neutron, which means that you have enough energy in the mass of a neutron to produce those three particles out of it. And so that means that neutrons are unstable. And that's the first evidence of the weak force that was actually seen. The same kind of process as this is actually responsible for why we can't directly see or hold in our hands all of those other particles that I, all of the particles on the upper rows of the table that I showed you. Because they also can decay this way. They can use interactions with W's to decay into lighter particles, and they do so really quickly. Okay. So the last bit that I should explain of the Standard Model is the strong force. And so let's just, I told you why we don't see the neutrinos. They would be up here on the table. I told you we don't see these guys, because they all decay thanks to the W. That leaves us with electromagnetism, with the electron that we see, with these quarks that we still don't see, and with the strong interactions. Now, what the strong interactions do, they're also at short distances a lot like electromagnetic interactions. But it turns out that at large distances, the force gets even stronger. Okay, and that's just a quantum mechanical difference between how the strong force works and the electromagnetic force works. And it's something that one can really understand mathematically, but that I won't be able to explain in this talk. The consequence of it, though, is something that you can understand. It's just that, let's say I have these quarks, and I start pulling them apart. And the force between them gets bigger and bigger as I pull them apart. Or actually, it stays about the same. The force stays about the same, which means the energy that I need in order to pull it, with electric forces, it's tough to pull a charge away from another charge for the first inch, but then the next inch gets easier and easier and easier because it's a one over r squared force. With this, it stays hard the whole way around, the whole way out. And so you need to put more and more energy into the system of these quarks as you pull it farther and farther. Eventually, you put in enough energy that it's actually enough that you've got enough stored energy to do that, to just create a new quark and anti-quark in the middle. And now you've got less stored energy in that strong potential because you've got this, because these guys are sort of neutralizing the forces felt by that up quark. Okay? So basically, what does that mean though? It means that you can never pull these quarks apart away from one another. Or in other words, you can never pull a quark away from all other quarks. You will always end up with some group of them that are hanging out clustered together. And this kind of group we've seen, it's called a proton. This kind of group we've seen, it's called a neutron. This kind of group is called a pion. And you can kind of tell just by looking at the picture, this doesn't look very stable because it's just got a particle and it's antiparticle. You know what particles and antiparticles can do? They can just collide with one another and decay into some gamma rays, into electromagnetic radiation, and that's exactly what these pions do. But the protons and the neutrons we do see. So that's why there's such a big gap between the particles we see around us and the particles we need to describe nature. So particles are building blocks of the quantum theory. Any quantum relativistic theory to describe that's consistent with those principles, we would expect to be built up of particles. And the particles are a way of sort of are a succinct language for describing what are all the different phenomena and matter and forces that we've seen, and how to understand them and how to make predictions using them. Particles can be created and destroyed in processes that have to conserve charge, but basically anything that conserves charge energy is allowed. Every charged particle has an antiparticle, and so it can be created if you put in enough energy into the process. And that means that a good way to hunt for new forces and new particles in nature is by looking for new particles out there. So what we've seen so far is this set of particles here. Well, this is pre-Higgs, sorry. But again, of which it was hard to see these guys, the neutrinos, because they're invisible. It was hard to see all these purple guys because they decay really fast into other particles. And it was hard to see these because they were this thing I just talked to you about with a strong force is called they're called confined. So it was pretty hard to actually figure out all of that structure that's hiding beneath there. And at least when I look at that, what I think to myself is, wow, if those were so hard to figure out, what else could we be missing? Right? How do we know that this is all there is? and that we're not missing other things, how do we go out and find anything else? And that was really the challenge that we faced, well, all through the last century of discovering all the stuff behind my boxes and in discovering the Higgs and that we still face today. How do we actually find this stuff? And the key, as I just mentioned to you, is looking at higher and higher energies. Okay, and so there's been this enormous succession of different accelerators going to higher and higher energies. The LHC is the last of them. All of them basically work with two principles, and you need none of what I just told you to understand them. Just classical electricity and magnetism. Electric force accelerates charged particles, right? Puts them in a potential. They feel a force. They get accelerated from a negative to a positive, if they're negatively charged particles, from a negative to a positive charge plate. And magnetic forces bend them. And so what you did in these old experiments was just have a big magnet and then some kind of some kind of capacitor or something. I'm actually not quite sure how they did it. I think it was basically a capacitor with a really big electric potential difference from one end to another. And as the particle swings through, every time it picks up a little bit more energy. But then it's also inside of a magnet, so it bends around in larger and larger circles. Now, so that required, so things moved on to these ring experiments that you see where there's just one circle, but you get basically the same effect where they're being bent around by magnets. What they did is they used electromagnets and the strength of those magnets changes with time. So you accelerate the particles and then you turn up the magnet a little bit. You accelerate the particle, you turn up the magnet a little bit. And that just keeps going. And so this culminates with the Large Hadron Collider. Actually, I lied when I said there's just one circle. You can only see one circle because it's the biggest of all the circles. But it's hard to control magnets at 1 millionth of their power. So what they actually do is they have a sort of a little ring that boosts their energy by a factor of a few. And then you get another power of 10 and another ring, another power of 10 and another ring, and your last power of 20 or so in the LHC ring of energy acceleration. That way, in each ring, you've got your magnets just covering a certain sort of reasonable range of strength. And you can keep those particles going around and around to higher and higher energies. And this is a 10-kilometer scale machine. So here in the bottom corner, you can see the Geneva Airport. It's not a small airport. And this red ring is the LHC ring. And the reason it needs to be so huge is just to keep bending protons around and around that are carrying higher and higher energy. Now, most of the time they just sail through there again and again and again once they've been accelerated, but every now and then, well, but the beams, there's actually two beams going through, one going clockwise, the other one going counterclockwise. And there's four points around the accelerator where they bring them together so that the two beams get really close. And that's where the interesting stuff happens. Most of the protons still don't really see each other. But sometimes they do. And sometimes they do spectacularly. And if you want to know what comes out, well, you're still going to get really high energy stuff coming out. And in order to study that high energy stuff, in particular to actually, you want to measure how energetic or how much momentum the particles coming out have, that basically means you have to bend them in a magnetic field, but they're still really high energy, even with really strong magnets. You need a big detector in order to see them in that magnetic field. So this is one of them on the left, the CMS detector. Blow that up a little bit. And You can see that it's sort of made up of different layers. Actually, in this picture, so there actually, this is, that's a person, but I guess they're, it's really hard to see anything other than their helmet in the picture. Sorry about that. This is only the outer couple of layers of the detector, actually. There's more layers inside. This is a sort of close-up view of one of them. And each layer does a different part of the measurement. So the idea is that you can tell what kind of particle you've produced in part by how it interacts with every layer. If I produce a charged particle, it'll deposit some energy in these little silicon layers on the inner part. If I produce a neutral particle, it goes right through. Electrons and photons dump most of their energy in this layer here, shown in green. The particles built out of quarks tend to go through that without interacting very much, deposit most of their energy in the yellow. And so then you have a lot of, and this last part, this is to detect the muons, which when I said that they decay really fast, they do re decay really fast, but it takes like microseconds. To me, microseconds is really fast, but if you're traveling at the speed of light, they can travel a long way before they decay. So as far as these experiments care, those muons basically travel straight through, and you can measure them all the way through before they decay. So that's the idea, is that these detectors are just taking big pictures of what comes out of those collisions and try to make sense of it. And here you can see a couple pictures of the other experiment, Atlas, with a slightly more visible person at the bottom this time. And this is an example of what the snapshots of these events look like. Okay, so in this case, this was an event where most of the energy is carried by these two particles that are going all the way through, hitting different places. And remember, the things that get to the very outer layer of the detector, those are the muons. So this, then you can tell from the direction, well, you can't tell from looking at the picture. With the precision that they have in the actual analysis, they can tell that one of these is bending to the left, one of them is bending to the right in the same magnetic field, which means that one of them is positively charged and one of them is negatively charged. So that's actually a muon and an anti-muon in the picture. And then there's other examples, an electron and an anti-electron. In this case, they didn't make it through very far, so they just show how much energy, and this circle basically shows how much energy was distributed where in that inner layer of the detector, the one that I showed in green. Now, that's all you see, but by looking at that event in detail, you can say, well, I don't know for sure, but probably with the energies of those two electrons, the directions they went, probably what happened is that we produced one of those Z particles, the ones responsible for the Z interaction, for the weak interaction, and then it decayed into an electron and a positron. And I'll explain a little bit more about how that analysis process works. Okay, now one more bit of sort of basic puzzle. To, because again, why are we going to analyze all these events? We better have a good reason. So there was the following thought experiment that really convinced people that there had to be a Higgs or something like it. And I want to tell you what that is. So I told you we have these great rules for calculating the different amplitudes and probabilities for something happening. So you can ask, just as a thought experiment, well, what if I took two of these W particles and smashed them together? And I do that at higher and higher energies. What would happen? And the great success of our theory is that we can calculate that probability. But the great failure was that we got something bigger than 100%. And it was sort of intimately related to the mass of the W in the sense that the energy that it becomes a problem at energies that are high compared to the mass. But if I asked the same question about W's that didn't have mass, I'd get no contradiction at all. So this says, okay, well, the theory's got to be incomplete, right? There's got to be something in the theory that fixes this so that when I calculate probabilities, I actually get things that sum to one instead of bigger than one. That's not a probability. And what that requires is basically a new force that changes how those W's interact with each other. So a new force, I could think about that as coming from a new field or a new particle. In this case, the Higgs field or the Higgs particle. And because the problem was tied to the W masses, you know that the coupling of the Higgs particle to the W and the Z would have to be precisely related to their masses in a particular way. And in fact, if I asked similar questions about knowing now the detailed structure of the standard model, about, say, top quarks colliding with each other, I'd find that the Higgs had better couple to them too. Otherwise, I get probabilities larger than one in top quark scattering, or top quark scattering off a W in particular as well. And that had also better be proportional to the top quark's mass. So what that means, what that tells us is that the Higgs particle and the Higgs field have to have this very peculiar structure where their couplings are related to particles' masses. So what that leads to is this really remarkable picture where the Higgs field is actually responsible for the particles with different particles' masses. Okay, and this is the one effect that you really should attribute to the field, not to the particles, because we have to say, field, the particles are like the local fields coming from, are related to the local fields coming from, if I have a proton, it can exchange Higgs particles or photon particles or whatever kind of particles with a nearby electron. But with the Higgs, there also seems to be this field filling all of space that's important to understanding the structure of all the particle masses. And those fields filling all of space seem to be responsible for giving the fundamental particles of the standard model their mass. So that makes the field obviously pretty important. And if you ask, well, what would happen if you took that field away? The electron wouldn't have mass, atoms would explode. The W and Z would be massless, radioactive decays would happen basically instantly. Actually, the proton would also be heavier than the neutron instead of the other way around. So instead of neutrons all decaying, protons would decay, and you wouldn't, yet another reason you wouldn't be able to have atoms. So it's actually really basic to just how the world works that there is this Higgs field everywhere. But the only way to learn how that Higgs field works is by studying the particles associated with it in detail. And so that's really what motivated going out and looking for the Higgs particle. Now, what we knew about it to start was just that that this Higgs particle should have couplings that are basically proportional to each particle's mass. So if you want to look for it, you'll look for it by trying to collide the particles with the highest mass. If you ask who has the highest mass in the standard model, it's the top quark, the W, and the Z. Well, that's too bad, because the things we can actually work with, the things that ordinary matter is made of that we can accelerate, are these tiny light particles with charges that are like 10 to the minus 5 level. So not a very efficient way of producing the Higgs. Well, this is where the quantum bank comes in again, because I just said that if we had a sort of hypothetical top quark anti-top quark collider, we could produce Higgses very efficiently. We don't have a top quark anti-top quark collider, but we do have lots of these gluons inside of protons at the LHC. And those gluons colliders can make a top anti-top particle pair, which means we can connect through the lots, borrow energy to make a top quark for a short period of time, and use those top quarks to produce a Higgs particle. So it's not a very efficient way to make the Higgs, but it's the best we've got. Just to compare, if you ask how often you make a W mass at the LHC, I told you it was pretty often because it's actually a pretty strong interaction. You make about 150 Ws every second. You make pairs of top quarks every 2 seconds. It's a little harder because they're heavier. And you make about five of these Higgs particles every minute. Now, like everything else that we've been talking about, you can make a Higgs particle, you can't keep it. It'll decay. So you have to look for it based on its decay modes. And those too, you can predict from this property I just mentioned, that all the interactions are proportional to particles' masses. So exactly how a Higgs particle would decay depends on its mass. But two of the most visible decay modes are the ones I've drawn here. One where you've got more of these sort of connecting quantum loops that give rise to photons. Or actually, you can get four electrons or electrons and muons coming through this Higgs coupling to the Z, which I also mentioned was very big. Of course, you don't see all of that. All you, whoa. Ah, sorry. Not that bad. Let's see if that slide crashes my PowerPoint again. Much better. Okay. All you see are the photons you got at the end of the day, or these electrons, say. So you might ask, how do you know that these are actually coming from a Higgs? Can I sort of glossed over the same question with the case where I was showing you two electrons or an electron and a positron coming from a Z? How do you know what it's coming from? How do you have any idea whether what you're producing is a Higgs or just some random crap? And basically, what you have is conservation of energy and momentum. So you know that if, let's say, you measure the energy and the momentum of that photon, the energy and the momentum of that photon. Actually, you know the energy and the momentum are mathematically related. So what you really need to measure is the energy and the direction, and then you can figure out the momentum vectors. Well, then you can combine them together to say if they both came from the same particle, and they were the only products of that particle, then the sum of the two photon momenta should equal the Higgs momentum. And the sum of the two photon energy should equal the Higgs energy. Well, I can still use formulas of relativity then to relate. Right, energy is the energy squared is the momentum squared plus the mass squared times powers of c. So I can relate the measured energies and the re measured momenta, use that to infer what mass of particle it would have had to come from. If you see a bunch of pairs of photons that all line up at the same mass, then that's a hint that you're producing a new particle. And that's actually what they saw. So they saw most of the photons were just all over the place. They're the random crap that I was talking about. There's a lot of that too at the LHC. But you see this bump here. And that bump of events piling up to the same mass, that's a sign that you had a Higgs. Now notice that if I take one of the events in that bump, or a sample of events in that bump, most of them are still the random crap. Most of them aren't Higgses. So I can't look at the Higgs at an event and say, yeah, that was probably a Higgs. Even if it's at the right mass, any given event is still probably just the random crap. Sorry, I don't have the technical word for it is background. any given event there is probably just background. But you combine the information from all of them and you see this clear signal. When you look at the events with four electrons, they're a little harder to see, they're a little rarer, but at least it's a little cleaner that So you don't have very many events. Actually, this has gotten a lot better since the original discovery papers. Now it's much more convincing. But you can again see these bumps. Actually, this first bump, this is associated with the Z. You can see it's much bigger than the one from the Higgs. Second bump from the Higgs. And most of the events in here, yeah, but you're still not sure that it was a Higgs, but there's a pretty good chance of it. So this is a good success. You predict a Higgs particle based on consistency. Then you find a particle matching the predictions. And it explains this basic difference between the weak interactions and the other ones, that the W and the Z have mass, which makes the weak force weak. Still raises a big puzzle, though, which is that that mass scale for the W and the Z is, I mean, there's a lot of different mass scales that an energy or length scales that or energy scales that you can think about in nature, going all the way from the sort of size of the universe way over here. I didn't even draw that. Size of the Earth, size of people, size of atoms, protons, W and Z. But pretty much everything to the left of here, we can explain from the properties of the Standard Model why there's such big differences, why planets are large, why people are small compared to planets but big compared to atoms. We have no idea where this big gap actually comes from between the scale of gravity and the scale where gravity becomes strong. So this is where, like, if I took two protons with an energy that big, I'd expect to produce black holes. Not just Higgs particles, but black holes. That's a whopping separation. And it's a separation that we don't understand. The Standard Model as a theory actually makes sense all the way up to that energy. At that energy, it breaks down, but that's so many orders of magnitude away that, it's not so bad. What makes it really bad is that if you take the Standard Model and thought, well, let's say the Standard Model makes sense up to that scale, then you'd have the following confusion, that you know there's quantum effects that contribute to the masses of the W particles and of the Higgs particle. So there's a classical piece and a quantum piece. The mass that we see is the sum of those two. And the quantum piece, we don't necessarily know how to calculate it, but we would sort of estimate it as being proportional to the largest scale at which the theory makes sense. If that largest scale at which the theory makes sense was way up here, strong gravity scale, like in other words, that really is the theory of nature all the way up to right around here where something new happens to explain quantum gravity. Then you would expect that that quantum piece is something like 100 quadrillion times larger than the actual W mass. So you'd need to have some cancellation between the quantum piece and the classical piece up to, actually it's really the mass squared, so it's really up to like 32 decimal places, not just the 16 that I've shown here. So this seems kind of crazy. Less crazy, I think, is that, I mean, it could be a crazy accident, but it would be crazy. Less crazy would be that actually this largest mass scale where that theory makes sense is somewhere down here. Then you only need like factors of a couple hundred accidents to explain the W mass. And the theory that takes over is as capable of explaining why the Z mass is small compared to that, compared to the highest theory, highest scale, as the theory we have is capable of explaining why people are bigger than atoms. Okay? And it would become then an answerable question in the sort of in the higher energy, more complete theory. But we have no answer in the Standard Model. So that leads a lot of physicists to suspect that at an energy pretty close to the weak scale, we should have, some modification of the theory associated with new particles that we haven't yet seen. And that's one of the main things that people are looking for, continuing to look for at the LHC and talking about building even higher energy machines to study. Another question that we might get a handle on possibly from the LHC is actually more of a cosmological puzzle, which is called dark matter. So basically, we have two ways of weighing galaxies. So one way that you can sort of estimate how heavy something is you sort of know what they're made of. You know their density, you measure how much stuff is in them. Another way, if the thing you're weighing is really heavy, is you look at how fast other things orbit around it. Right? So like we can weigh the sun by how fast we know the Earth's sun distance, we know the period of the Earth's motion, and we know Newton's constant, we can weigh the sun from that. If you look at stars around the Milky Way or around some other galaxy, in this case Andromeda, at different distances, you're weighing by measuring how fast they orbit around the center of the galaxy, you're weighing how much matter's inside. And it just doesn't match. Especially at large distances, it really doesn't match even remotely well what you would expect from the amount of matter that we actually see in there. That was, well, actually, the first evidence came from similar measurements in what are called galaxy clusters. You see it in galaxy clusters, you see it in galaxies, you see it also from looking at snapshots of the early universe. There's something out there that's gravitating. That's a lot more important in mass, in terms of the total mass that it contains, than the ordinary matter, but that we can't see. And so that's what we call dark matter. And the reason I had this really squiggly, uncertain picture for it is that we really don't know what it is. We haven't seen it. We know that it should be built from some kind of new particles, but we don't know what they are. All we know about them is that it doesn't have an electric charge, doesn't have a strong interaction charge. You might still be able to produce it at the LHC, and I'll sort of leave as a little puzzle for you how you might know that you're producing something like dark matter when it doesn't have any of the interactions that you could use to actually see it directly. Okay, how might you know that you had produced it? There's another possibility, though. I told you that we know that dark matter can interact with us through the weak intera through the strong interactions, through the electromagnetic interactions. We also know just qualitatively there can't be any force through which it interacts with us too much. So its interactions have to be pretty weak. Well, there's two ways that things can be weak. They can be weak like the weak interactions, which is to say they're pretty strong at short distances, but then because they're carried by heavy particles, that force just cuts off at larger distances. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that it's just weak, like the way weak sounds to an ordinary person, that the force is just weaker, even at very short distances. It just got, it's just like gravity's weak between two particles, right? Maybe stronger than that, but weaker than electromagnetic interactions. In the first case, if it's interacting through heavy particles, then that's what something like the LHC is really good at testing. But if it's intrinsically weak, then the LHC, because it's such a busy, messy environment, is actually not the right place to do it. What you want is really high-powered but smaller experiments. And so I'll tell you in just a couple of minutes about some of these smaller experiments, some that I'm involved in and some that I'm not. Okay, so but the general theme here is how do we look for forces that are just intrinsically really weak? So we can look for them in a similar way to how we looked for the Z, which is by trying to produce the particle associated with that force and then looking for its decays. But we need less energy and we need more power because we're trying to look for a smaller signal. So one place that I've been working on this kind of experiment is Jefferson Lab in Virginia. So this is still, honestly, calling this a small experiment is a bit of a stretch because this is still a 1 kilometer scale accelerator. But hey, that's like a tenth the size of the LHC. And in terms of the energy that it's accelerating particles to, it's accelerating electrons to a thousandth the energy of the LHC. The reason that you still need something so big to accelerate them less is that the electrons just go through this ring five times, whereas the protons of the LHC get accelerated over and over and over again, like thousands of times. So that's why this is still pretty big, even though it's a much lower energy. The other big difference between the physics you do at Jefferson Lab and the LHC is that we don't have electrons going two ways and colliding with one another in the same accelerator. We just have electrons hitting plates of stuff at Jefferson Lab. And the reason that that's so effective is that we want power. We want a lot of interactions. And it's a lot easier to get a whole lot of interactions from electrons hitting a plate of stuff than from trying to precisely collide two little beams of electrons. So some of the experiments that we do, now this part's actually small. Some of the experiments that we do are basically looking right in front of where that collision happens for a pair of, an electron-positron pair. And then we want to do the same thing as that Higgs to two photon analysis. So we want to look at the mass. If I detect an electron, we detect a positron. We want to know, did they come from something, some x? You look at what the mass of the x would have to be based on the energy and momentum of those. You're going to get some background. And you want to see whether you find a little bump on top of that. That would be the signal of a new particle mediating this weaker force. You need a lot of events so that you can resolve very small dimples over just the random noise that you're going to get, that some bins have more events than others. So this is actually a little experiment. Let's see. In this lighting, you can't really see much inside. So here are some people for scale. You can see the people on this one. They're not little dots. And this is the HPS detector, which basically has a bunch of little plates of silicon inside of this tube that you can see is like the whole tube is about the size of his forearm in width, and it's about a meter long. There's other kinds of experiments sort of related that might look for dark matter itself at this kind of facility. And then as you go to even weaker forces, you start doing very different types of measurements. So for very weak but very long-range forces, things that might be relevant on millimeter scales, there's these high-precision torsion balances that people make. And there's some searches for particles that could be dark matter and mediate a very weak force called ADMX, that it's basically using a big resonant electromagnetic cavity to try to turn the energy in these particles into electromagnetic energy. So those are just a couple of examples, and I know I've only given a, really glossed over them. But I just want to back out now, conclude with what's next. So we have these foundations from quantum mechanics and relativity that lead us to expect that whatever we discover, it'll take the form of particles, and particles will be a useful way of understanding it. There's some definite open questions that we know have to have answers, so we know we're not totally done. We don't understand what's going on with the Higgs mass. We have no idea what the dark matter is. There's more questions like that. And it's really not clear where the answers will come from. For some of these questions, like what's going on with the Higgs mass, we really need high energies, big machines. So the LHC just this summer has started up again with double the energy that it had for the Higgs discovery. We'll see what that turns up. And we also need new ideas and little experiments to just explore further more broad possibilities that aren't necessarily best studied at really high energies anymore. What I hope you take with you, if nothing else from this talk, is that the laws of nature that we're trying to understand at the LHC, they're really exactly the same. We're really trying to understand what are the laws of nature in this room. Okay, it's just that if you go to the right environment, really high energies, many of those laws come into sharper focus and become easier to understand. So a lot of times people ask me what I expect to find. And it's fun to speculate, but ultimately, if I knew what we expected to find, I'd be a lot less interested. I think the unexpected has often been the thing that broadens our scientific perspective the most. And well, Einstein said it really well too. So I think we have cause to be excited about the future, to expect some new discoveries, and to really be excited and motivated to try to come up with new ideas and new places to look for fundamental physics phenomena. So that's it. Thanks. Yeah, I have probably like 10 minutes or so. Yeah, go ahead.
What do you mean by what's going on with the Higgs mass? What's special about the Higgs mass?
Ah, so good. I talked about it earlier, I guess, in terms of the W mass. So basically, the Higgs mass, the properties of the Higgs end up setting the masses for everything else in the Standard Model. They all sort of go together. So really, when I ask about the Higgs mass, I'm asking about what's going on with all the masses. And this problem that I was talking about, that we think that if the Standard Model made sense up to really high energies, then we'd have this like fine-tuning of 32 decimal places of the quantum piece and the classical piece in order to get the right answer. So that's what I meant. But it is really confusing to chalk it up to just one particle the way I did, because in a sense, there's one parameter in the theory, which is the Higgs mass, that controls the masses of everything we see, at least of all the fundamental particles. And it's really that parameter that everything scales with that we're confused about, not one particular particle. Yeah.
I'm just wondering about the weak force, how it has two bosons, you say. Two force-carrying particles, the Z and the W. But they seem to do completely different things. So why is it classified under a single force?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. So it really has to do with the fact, let's see. It's a good question, it's a hard one. So suppose that the symmetry, suppose there was no Higgs and that the W and the Z were massless particles and everything else was massless too. Okay, so then for example, like we said the W changes an electron into a neutrino, and that's weird. Well, but if the W and the Z were massless and the electron and the neutrino were massless, then there would really be no way. Let's push that further. Why is that weird? It's weird because we can identify an electron, like it has an electric charge. A neutrino does not. They have different masses. They feel very different. But in this limit that I just described, where none of the particles got mass and there was no Higgs, those differences that let you articulate why it's weird would go away. So you would actually, a physicist in that world, I don't know how that world could have physicists because it can't have atoms, but hypothetically, a physicist in that world would say, ah, there's this pair of particles, electron and neutrino, or they'd probably just call them electron A and electron B, that are interacting with one another. And you've got a force that mixes A and B, that changes A to B. And you've got a force that just attracts things. But you could actually build a larger symmetry to relate those two to one another. and say, well, I could just change my description. I could use, instead of A and B, I could use A plus B and A minus B. And I'd get exactly the same kind of behavior. I'm just labeling my states differently. And now the roles of the Z and the W, the W wouldn't necessarily change particle types any more than the Z does. So that's what I mean by a symmetry. That the so in other words, I could take that. So they would really start to look like, well, if I change how I label my electron A, electron B, that's equivalent to interchanging what I mean by the W and the Z. And they would start to look a lot more similar in that limit. Now, so actually, what I didn't tell you, see, it's all about what I tell you and what I don't tell you. What I didn't tell you about the gluons is that there's eight of them. But it's exactly like this, that because, well, we never actually see the quarks, but if we did see the quarks, we'd say every quark, there's three different types of quark. And we can call them, people actually call them red, green, and blue instead of A and B. But we can't tell the difference between a red quark and a green quark in any invariant way. And the different colors, the different types of gluons also have like colory names. So you can't so you really can't distinguish. Like I can't say, oh, this gluon is special. But what happens with the weak interactions is actually that when you give the W and the Z mass, there's a, well, it's really pretty complicated. What happens is, but really cool. That's why I'm actually trying my best to answer your question on the spot. Is that the electron and, sorry, is that the Z isn't exactly the same as the W. There's a combination of the Z and the photon that looks like the W. And the result of that is that some of the particles get charged, they get different masses, and you actually start being able to tell the difference between electrons and neutrinos in a really invariant way. But as you go to this sort of really high energy part of the theory, where the W and the Z masses don't matter anymore, you start seeing this symmetry where it actually looks a lot like electromagnetism, except with three, because there's the charge, W's of both charges. So it's actually three particles. Except with those three kinds of force carriers instead of just one. Sorry. Yeah.
How does the particle prop or sorry, how does the particle model explain wave properties?
Good question. So I don't think you're gonna like my answer though. So I remember I said when I say the word particle, I'm not necessarily talking about a ball of stuff. What I really mean is something with a momentum and a spin. So a wave also has a momentum and a spin, right? Well, you don't usually think about them. Like a light wave, you think about as having a polarization, and that's closely related to a spin. And obviously, it's got a direction that it's following. So if you have a small, so it carries momentum too. So in a sense, what I mean by a particle is a very small wave. But in a sense, what I mean by a particle behaves, sometimes it behaves more like a particle. And yeah, that's that sort of gets down to when you gets down into the mud of definitions. But yeah, in order to consistently talk about a particle in quantum mechanics, you have to really talk about this thing that sort of has all these wave particle duality properties. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Neutrinos actually get their mass not by interacting with the Higgs field, but by another mechanism. Can you please expand on that?
No, because we actually don't know for sure how the neutrinos get their mass. It is possible that they get their mass through an interaction with the Higgs field directly, and it's possible that they get their mass through something a little bit more complicated. So yeah, actually, by the way, yeah, I forgot that you guys had recently been to Snow Lab. So I don't know if, did you see Snow Plus? Yeah, so did you recognize the Snow Plus picture earlier? Okay, so, oh, I mean, that was actually snow, but anyway. Why am I going back in my slides? You saw the real thing. It's much better than this picture. yeah, so one of the things that Snow Plus in particular is looking for is this possibility of a totally different type of mass for the neutrino, which is called a Majorana mass. And that would actually also involve the Higgs in some way, but it would have to involve also some interactions beyond just the interactions with the Higgs. Go ahead.
Two questions. First one is just like, could you explain more about the coupling? You mentioned coupling multiple times, and I don't really understand what that is.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, that's just me using my target too much. So
coupling is basically just the strength of interactions between two particles. So for example, when we or between in any combination of particles. So for example, when we talk about the charge of an electron in this sort of quantum way of thinking about it, you would call that charge also the strength of the coupling between the electron and the photon. So the electric charge is an example of a coupling. But anytime you have different particles that interact with one another, say electrons and photons, or the top quark and a Higgs, whatever the strength is of that interaction, which controls, if you like, how often when you start with one particle, it's gonna, or when this particle scatters, it's going to produce that particle. That's called a coupling. So electric charge is the most familiar example. But then it generalizes to all these other cases.
What do you think of string theory? I heard people can't even prove it wrong because the energy required is so high that you can't even do experiments with it. So what do you think about that? Is it useful?
Right. So I think the
So it's certainly true that most of the time when people think about string theory, it's really as a theory of this really people think of string theory as really having new consequences up in sort of this part of the plot right up here, which we're not going to be able to test experimentally anytime. So in terms of experimental consequences, string theory is kind of not that directly relevant. What's cool is that these consistency conditions of just quantum mechanics and relativity actually give you a lot of constraints on if relativity and quantum mechanics are like exact principles and not approximations, plus what we've seen about gravity, give you lots of constraints on how these gravitational interactions could conceivably look. And it might be possible, nobody's done it yet, but it might be possible mathematically to establish that string theory or some appropriate generalization of string theory is actually the unique possibility consistent with those principles and with gravity at these high scales. People have tried many different ways of getting of consistently describing gravity at energy scales where it's very strong in a way that maintains exact relativistic behavior and consistency with quantum mechanics. And it's easy to get inconsistencies there. Like even easier than with it's sort of like these problems that you run into with the W. Right? That was a case where you just follow for the WW scattering. I said you just follow the rules of your theory. And you get nonsense out. The one condition you have is that if quantum mechanics is going to be right, you should be able to write down a theory where you calculate things and you don't get nonsense out. And that's actually a pretty powerful constraint. Now, like I said, some people speculate that constraint might be enough to basically to say string theory is the only thing that passes the constraint. That's never been shown rigorously, okay? But it's a program of things that you can try to study, and what's and see whether whether there's some whether string theory itself or some generalization of it might actually have that property, and that would be really a really useful thing to know. The other thing that I think is worth saying is that just having a consistent framework for asking strong gravity questions, even if you don't know whether it's the right one or not, is still a lot better than having none, because you can start asking questions about the implications of that theory and make some progress trying to then figure out, well, is that just a consequence of this specific theory, or is it a consequence of the framework, quantum mechanics plus gravity, general relativity, more broadly. So I think it's definitely a useful tool for asking scientific questions. And that is totally separate from thinking that it will never be directly tested experimentally. Right? Both things can be true at the same time. Yeah?
Now, I know supersymmetry is an important part of string theory. As the LHC doesn't find any signs of supersymmetry partners with more and more energy, does that get less plausible?
Right, actually, supersymmetry is also, good, it came back. So supersymmetry is also one of the sort of leading hypotheses for how to explain where that gulf of scales might come from. And the LHC has looked for supersymmetry up to about here on my graph. And it'll be looking up to about here with the doubling of energy. Higher energy colliders might be able to get up to here. Okay? And so I'm making a couple of points with that. The first one is that by testing supersymmetry up to here, you've learned absolutely nothing about whether there could be supersymmetry anywhere over here, right? So saying that it gets much less plausible, anything gets much less plausible as far as the existence of supersymmetry in some abstract sense in nature, would be, I think, a gross overstatement based on just exploring 3 out of 16 orders of magnitude. But the second thing I said was that supersymmetry can help explain this gulf. And wherever supersymmetry happened to be, if it's actually realized in nature, it would only explain the part of the gulf to the right of that point. So if there had been supersymmetry down here that we could have found before the LHC, it would answer this problem really, really well of why there's this big separation of mass scales. If there's supersymmetry up here, doesn't do much of a good job. Yeah, it changes a 10 to the 32 problem into a 10 to the 25 problem, but that's still pretty bad. So it wouldn't be directly relevant to that problem. We're now in a region where, like, it looks like a 10 to the 2, 10 to the 3 problem is the best we could be doing, right? So we're not totally explaining the Higgs mass, but I think it's still pretty plausible that, you know, that either the next rounds of the LHC or the next generation colliders could find supersymmetry. It's also totally plausible that they wouldn't, and that we're really missing something about where this hierarchy of scales comes from. But I think supersymmetry is certain as a solution of this puzzle is certainly less plausible now than it was before the LHC, just because the sort of most compelling region of parameter space that was allowed when I went into grad school, we've looked at, and we didn't find anything, right? So it's a lot less plausible as a solution of this problem. But then if you ask the question, is it plausible that it's realized somehow, somewhere in nature? Who knows? There's, you know, if we probe up to here, yeah, it's still plausible that it's somewhere out, you know. Lots of things are plausible up there.
For our next talk, and I know we have some.
Yeah, I should head out too.
It's a good sign. It's definitely a good talk. There's tons of questions.